Most first ladies of the United States have been truly remarkable women. Many have made their mark as diplomats and activists. But when the eyes of the world are on you, you really have to think about what you wear. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the fashion of the first ladies. My guest is historian and author Annette Dunlap. She's the author of Frank, the story of Frances Folsom Cleveland, America's youngest first lady. And she's working on a biography of Lew Henry Hoover. We'll talk about gowns, dresses, designers, pantsuits, and politics this hour. We also want to hear from you. Who do you feel was the most fashionable first lady? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We think about Jacqueline Kennedy's pillbox hats, Pat Nixon's cloth coat, Barbara Bush's pearls, Hillary Clinton's pantsuits. The fashion choices made by America's first ladies get noticed, and there is often a lot more behind their choices than what an outfit looked like. This hour, we'll talk about the fashion of the first ladies, and my guest is historian and author Annette Dunlap. She's the author of Frank, the story of Frances Folsom Cleveland, America's youngest first lady, and she's working on a biography of Lew Henry Hoover. She'll be speaking at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Her talk is First Ladies and the Politics of Fashion. Annette, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, you know, First Ladies do work so hard, and so many of them have really carved a role for themselves as diplomats, as social activists, but what they wear is extraordinarily important. I mean, the eyes of the entire world are on them. When I think about how much first ladies get covered, this seems to be the number one thing we talk about when it comes to first ladies.
Absolutely. I think a really good example of that at current times is Michelle Obama. We are tracking everything she wears, where it's been made, where she's bought it from, whether it's from J. Crew or a designer. And we're also checking out her new do because she has been experimenting with hairstyles recently.
Bangs. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. A la Mamie Eisenhower, maybe?
Well, let's go back in time because, of course, the first job of the first lady was and is to be the hostess for the president, to welcome people into the White House once there was a White House. And when we think about hostesses, I think in the United States, a lot of us think about Dolly Madison, who was there close to the beginning of making the role of the first lady.
Right. And I think it's probably good to put a time frame on that. So we're in the process of celebrating the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. So Dolly Madison was the first lady in the White House during those years. So 200 years later, we're still thinking about her as the hostess. But I would point out that as far as we are able to tell, she is really the first lady who established the idea of the first lady being a hostess, because Martha Washington did not live in the White House. It was not constructed at that time. Abigail Adams spent perhaps a half a year in the White House because it was just getting finished up at the end of the Adams administration. Thomas Jefferson was a widower, and Dolly actually assisted him with events and dinners that he hosted. But the idea of being a hostess and inviting members of Congress and diplomats to come in and enjoy a meal and exchange ideas and talk with one another in a friendly setting really gets credited to Dolly.
And, of course, at that time, all politicians were men. And many of them had wives. So Dolly was really the head of the Washington social scene as well, right?
Right. Although a lot of the wives did not accompany their husbands. Congress didn't meet forever and ever back in the early 1800s like they do now. They came for 3 or 4 months. They did the business of the nation and they went back home. So a lot of these were men only. You might have had a few diplomats from overseas who brought their wives, but it was a very male-dominated environment, and it allowed her to shine.
It is amazing to me that 200 years later, we still do seem to hold up Dolly Madison as the gold standard of the hostess and of the first lady.
And as a fashion icon.
So what did she wear?
Well, she wore a lot of clothing made in France. She imported dresses from France. In fact, she had a shipment coming over about the time that the British blockaded shipping into the United States and sweated out whether or not her dresses were going to make it. And she imitated the Empress Josephine because Napoleon was ruling France and gradually ruling a lot of Europe at that time. And Josephine's style was low neckline and show a little bosom. And that is exactly what Dolly did. In fact, Abigail Adams, who, if you ever see a picture of her, she is looks like the quintessential Puritan wife with the mob cap on her head and a shawl over a dress that already has a high-necked collar. And Abigail's comment was that Dolly in her dresses looked like a nursing mother.
So did people look askance at that other than Abigail Adams? Did other people think, "Ooh, Dolly"?
Well, we have some quotes from other people of the Quaker faith, which Dolly came from a Quaker background. She is from Guilford County, North Carolina. I have adopted North Carolina as my home state. I've lived there a number of years, and Guilford County was a Quaker stronghold. And so there was a friend of hers who was a Quaker. Quaker men typically wore hats as a sign of humility. Dolly saw her friend and said, "Friend," which is how Quakers referred to one another, "friend, where is thy hat?" And apparently this gentleman looked at her and said, "Friend, where is thy kerchief?" Because she didn't have anything covering up the décolletage.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned her dresses from France. And, of course, in the early years of our presidents, there was some struggle over how this branch of government would really be in our nation, as far as would the president be like a king? Would it be like royalty? You mentioned, I mean, there are other first ladies who sort of tried to take on the role of queen. Let's talk about Angelica Van Buren.
Angelica Van Buren was the daughter-in-law of Martin Van Buren. And actually, Dolly figures in this story as well, because Dolly was Angelica's aunt.
And to be a first lady, you do not have to be the wife of the president.
That's correct. Exactly. And I think that's a good point, because we have several, as Dolly being the hostess for Thomas Jefferson is a good example, and then several others after that. But Martin Van Buren was a widower, and he had four sons. And Dolly did not like the fact that the five men had turned the White House into a bachelor pad, which is basically what happened. And so Angelica had come to visit some relatives, and Dolly was there, and Dolly introduced Angelica to Abraham Van Buren, Martin's son, and they actually fell in love and got married. And so Abraham, doing some diplomatic work on behalf of his father, took a honeymoon to England, and they had an opportunity to have an audience with Queen Victoria. And Angelica liked a lot of what she saw there. And so she came back and she sat on a throne to receive people, and that did not go over too well.
I can imagine. I mean, particularly since, although she was first lady, she was not married to the president. And so, but she actually had a throne constructed for herself?
She had a dais and a throne to sit on to receive people. But also Van Buren comes in right after Andy Jackson. And Andy Jackson loved to let people come through the White House. You didn't have to have an appointment. You just showed up. You walked in the door. And he met whoever came in all day long. And Martin Van Buren, who was a little more aristocratic and from New York, had different attitudes and ideas. He did not see the White House as a place for just anybody. And so he restricted who came to dinner. He had small dinner parties instead of large sort of raucous affairs. And I should point out that Andrew Jackson's wife had also passed away, and he was a widower. So the White House had been a bachelor pad for several administrations. But these two bachelors ran things a little differently.
Right.
So folks were not too happy with Martin anyway, because he wasn't doing things like Andy Jackson did. And then you get Angelica, and she adds this sort of pro-Brit twist, and it's not well received.
How long did that last?
Well, Van Buren only served one term. I think that says it all.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Frances Folsom Cleveland. And I know we could spend the whole hour talking about Frances Folsom Cleveland, and you are one of her biographers. She was America's youngest first lady. How old was she?
She was 21 years old when she married Grover Cleveland. And actually, we are getting ready to celebrate the 150th anniversary of her birth, which will be on July 21st. And so she and Cleveland married on June 2nd. So you can see she was almost 22, but not quite. And he was 49.
Wow.
So if you do the math, it's basically 47 and a half year age difference. Excuse me, 27 and a half year age difference.
And so when he went to the White House, how old was she?
Well, they got married in the White House.
Got married
in
the White House.
It was a White House wedding.
Okay.
So he was elected president in 1884, which meant he came in March of 1885 because the presidency started in March at that time. And they married in June of 1886. So he, of course, would have been 47, 48 when he became president, marries her essentially the next year after he's taken office.
Now, I can imagine that a White House wedding, and there have been a few of them over the years, and usually not first ladies involved, but would get a lot of attention, even at that time.
It got a lot of attention, and the curiosity, a couple of curiosities, is this was basically a throw-together affair. Frances and her mother and her cousin had gone to Europe for the summer, the fall and winter before the wedding. They were coming back in May. The original plan was for her to be married at the home of her grandfather. Her father had passed away when Frances was 11, but her grandfather passed away when they were en route to come back from Europe. And so the decision was made very quickly to go ahead and get married in the White House. And Grover had been keeping all this a secret because he was afraid of exactly what happened, which was a media frenzy, which is what happened. So the word got out that the president was to get married and that he was engaged, and there was this huge effort to hide Frances when she and her family got off the boat. The reporters scoured all of New York to try to find out where the Folsoms were staying. They were pretty well able to keep it quiet, but not for too long. And then Frances kind of makes her debut at what was then called Decoration Day, we now call Memorial Day Parade in Washington, which would have been the last Monday of May. And then she shows up in D.C. on the early morning of June 2nd, about 6:30 in the morning, June 2nd, to get married later that afternoon. And the wedding was pretty much put together by Grover's sister, Rose. His youngest sister had been functioning as his hostess prior to this marriage.
All right. Well, we will talk more about Frances Folsom Cleveland and other first ladies, their fashion choices, the statements that those fashions have made, and of course, the politics of fashion as well as the hour goes on. And we would love to hear from you, too. Is there a first lady whose fashion you particularly admire? You can post on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Are there some choices that you've seen over the years that you are curious about the backstory to those choices? Annette may be able to help you out with that. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. With me this hour is historian and author Annette Dunlap. She'll be speaking at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Her talk is entitled First Ladies and the Politics of Fashion. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the fashion of the first ladies. And with me is historian and author Annette Dunlap. She is the author of Frank, the story of Frances Folsom Cleveland, America's youngest first lady. She'll be talking about the first ladies and their fashion choices at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we were just talking about Frances Folsom Cleveland. And so she was 21 years old when she married into the White House, a beautiful young woman. And really, what kind of a fashion icon did she become?
Well, I want to say before we get started and answer your question, we need to put our heads back into 1886 and realize that this woman became a fashion icon with pencil sketches in newspapers, photographs that were not posted to the internet, and, you know, some telegraph.
Right.
So it's just really a testimony to how impressive she was. One of the first things they copied was her hairstyle. She wore her hair up and with an interesting twist on the front, a little bit of the hair clipped in the nape of the neck, and they called it a la Cleveland. And all the women went in and started to want to have their hair styled that way. And another thing, and I think it's a little bit of an urban legend, even though I do put the story in the book, is that apparently some newspaper reporters were very bored in a late August afternoon and were looking for a story to write. And this is, and they thought, well, anything about Mrs. Cleveland sells papers. So they decided to write that she had given up the bustle. And for those who may not know what a bustle is, just turn on a baseball game, look at a catcher's mask, and then just think about having that on your backside, because that's pretty much what a bustle is. And the fashion designers liked bustles because it meant that they had to sell yards and yards of fabric to cover this extra wire contraption that was on the hips of the women.
Mm-hmm.
So the story went that Mrs. Cleveland had given up the bustle.
And it wasn't true?
Well, the rest of the story is that she went shopping when she got back from her vacation. She's back in D.C. She goes shopping with her friend in Washington and asks to look at a bustle. And the clerk looks at her and says, but Mrs. Cleveland, ever since you gave up the bustle, nobody else has asked for them. We've put them in the basement. So if you want one, we can go down and get you a bustle to look at. And Frances apparently looked at her shopping companion and said, well, if they say that I have given up the bustle, then I guess I have. And she went out and had her dresses modified the next day.
Oh, wow. So was she a popular figure?
She was extremely popular, much more popular than Grover Cleveland was. As a matter of fact, she was so popular that when he ran for re-election in 1888, that there was a smear campaign saying that he beat her and that he abused her in the White House as an effort to make him look terrible, because they knew that the public perceived this as a love match and they were enamored with the two of them together. And it really, as a couple, they were pretty much unstoppable. And so this was an effort. And ironically, Cleveland did win the popular vote, but lost the electoral vote. But they were back 4 years later.
Now, where was she getting her dresses from? We've talked about the French fashions coming in. Was she buying also foreign fashions?
Yes, she was buying foreign fashions. The trip to Europe pre-marriage was to purchase clothing and a trousseau, and she bought many things from the French fashion houses. She had a great eye for design, and she did have dresses from the House of Worth, which was a Parisian couturier Worth was actually an Englishman who had moved to France and had gained a business as a French couturier with the way that he matched fabric and the color and cut that he used. But in the second administration, which would have been the 1893, the 1897, what she did was she used American dressmakers using French designs.
Interesting.
And there's an interesting little story that shows up about one of her dressmakers out of Baltimore, Lottie Barton, who was actually arrested for having a trunk full of French fashion that was apparently not allowed to be imported. It was against the tariff. But what a lot of American dressmakers did was they would import these French dresses and then show them to their clients so that the clients could pick which ones. And then the American dressmakers would copy the French designs.
Wow. And I want to go back in time a little bit because Kathy is on the line from Iowa City. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi. Who would you like to talk about?
Well, I went on a day trip over to Galena last month with a friend of mine. And, we did the tour of the house. And we were told by the guide who was kind of on a tape. You know, we couldn't really ask any questions.
And the tour of Ulysses S. Grant's house.
She had a script. Yep. And what we were struck with, she looked like she was fat. I thought she had nice outfits and stuff, but I guess she had a lazy eye, we were told, and was a little uncomfortable about it. But
you're talking about Mrs. Grant, right?
Mrs. Grant, and we were told that she was immensely popular and was very friendly and invited people into the White House, but she was so grim looking in every picture we saw of her, and I just wonder if that was the fashion of the day, that just kind of looked grim.
All right, Mrs. Grant, let's talk about her, Annette.
Well, you're right. Mrs. Grant was extremely popular, and she actually was a fashion icon for her day. And the story about the lazy eye is she really wanted it to be corrected. They had the surgery to correct it, but Grant apparently liked her like it, and she left it alone. A lot of the way that pictures were taken at that time were to put a brace on the neck of the person in order to hold them still, because you had to stay perfectly still for quite a bit of time in order for the exposure to actually take. And actually, if you look at pictures of the Lincolns, which is when we first start to get a lot of serious photography of our presidents, and all of them actually until more modern day, to look grim and to look serious was, first of all, sort of what was expected, but also it had to do with the fact of how still they had to stay. And they may have actually been in some type of
pain.
Contraption.
Right.
Yeah, they were in pain for exactly until the exposure took place, because they were actually photographing on like glass plates.
Right.
And before we got into some of the more sophisticated ways to do photography.
All right. So she was more charismatic than she looked in her
photographs.
Absolutely.
That's a good question. A very good one.
All right, Kathy, thank you so much for your call. Well, let's move on from Frances Cleveland. And as time goes on, how is the role of the First Lady changing? Because, I mean, we see First Ladies as hostesses, as these socialites in many ways, as these fashion icons. Is the role starting to shift?
Oh, yes. The role has shifted quite a bit. And really, I don't want to jump too far ahead historically in the record. Mm-hmm. I put a lot of credit to that shift to Lou Henry Hoover. And I guess we'll get to that in a minute. But you had women, for example, like Dolly. I think Julia Grant is another excellent example, who had a certain level of Abigail Adams, although she really wasn't in the White House that much. We had some first ladies who were better educated. Sarah Polk would be another example, who had husbands that encouraged them to share their views, who talked to their wives about possibly making policy. And they had behind-the-scenes roles as first ladies. And then we had quite a number of other first ladies. Frances is in this category, where the husbands kind of determined what the roles were going to be, and the wives accepted that, because that's also sort of where things were socially. I don't remember the exact date. We may have a listener who can call in with the information. But I think it's important to realize that for at least the first 100 years of this country, women were basically considered property of their husbands, were not necessarily allowed to own property of their own, couldn't sign legal documents. So to have some independent first ladies in that first century of our existence as a republic is pretty impressive.
Well, and I think let's move on to Lou Henry Hoover. And of course, she's one of Iowa's first ladies. We have two. And Lou was such a fascinating woman. I think for Iowans, a lot of Iowans know quite a bit about her, but she's one of those figures that has been somewhat lost to history. And tell us a little bit about her and the choices that she made as far as what to wear. Because so many of the pictures that I see of Lou Henry Hoover, she's dressed very practically. She was a very active woman. She loved to be outdoors, and she was a career woman as well. So I see her in a lot of practical outfits, but she also was considered one of the best dressed.
She was. A lot of people don't realize that during the years that Herbert Hoover was cabinet secretary under first Harding, well, he was there in the Wilson administration, not as a cabinet secretary, but serving in other functions. But then he was in the cabinets under Harding and Coolidge. But Lou was considered one of the best dressed cabinet wives in Washington, D.C. And she is the first lady to have her photograph taken for Vogue magazine. So she started a trend, because Vogue has done a shoot on every single first lady since Lou.
Wow.
As you say, Lou is from here in Iowa. The story is she is named Lou, not Louise, that Daddy did sort of hope for a boy. But her parents allowed her to be out, to run around, to learn. She learned how to fish. She learned how to shoot a rifle. She learned how to ride a horse. She was extremely active outdoors. Her parents encouraged this and supported it. She was also quite brilliant. So she was a great student and a very loving and a very caring woman. And you see this when you read her letters, you see this started as a child. But yes, you're right. One of the things that I think is interesting is we don't see her very often in pants, although we would have seen her in riding outfits with the split skirt or the riding skirt. But yes, her clothing, her practical clothing was freedom of movement. But you see, fashion had also changed by that point, because after the end of when we went into World War One, we really began to realize that a lot of these extra petticoats, the corsets, anything that was going to restrict women's movement made it difficult for women to take on some of the jobs that men were doing. When the war ended, we didn't go back to some of that more restrictive wear. We went into what we now think of as the Roaring Twenties. You see this in Grace Coolidge, who had an absolutely perfect figure for those straight shifts. Kind of a small bosom, small hips, and just kind of you wear it from the shoulders and it just hangs down without a lot of pleats, without a lot of extra little fancy gewgaws and frou-fra, if you will. And Lou is already that style also works for Lou's active life.
Well, and let's talk about the politics of what she wore, because of course, being the president's wife during the Great Depression, as you know, the country is plunged into this horrible economy, she had to make choices about what kind of money she would spend on her clothes, didn't she?
She made choices about what kind of money she spent, but she made choices about where that money was spent, and it was spent in the United States. Her clothing was American made, it was American designed, and as the Depression started to deepen and the farmers were really not getting paid well for their crops, she started to wear a lot of cotton, and sort of including having a cotton gown made for a diplomatic event that she was hosting at the White House. That raised a lot of eyebrows. I am going to be showing a photo of that, or I think I did send that to you. It's on the website. And you don't see some of the detail in that, but it actually has some flowers woven into it. It is a very intricately designed, lovely, lovely gown. But the fashion writers, which of course that was all that women were covered on, was the social pages,
right,
and what they wore. The fashion writers were all up in arms. You know, it's like, where's the velvet? Where's the satin? You know, where's the lace? But this was part of Lou's statement saying, let's support our American farmers, you know, buy things in cotton.
Was she the first lady to really make buying American a priority?
I think she was. There may be somebody who knows a little bit more than I do about it, but from everything that I am able to tell, yes.
Did that start a trend that continued? Did first ladies who followed feel that they needed to shop in the United States?
Well, you don't hear too much about it with Eleanor Roosevelt, although I would suspect with things the way they were with World War II, I would suspect most of what Eleanor bought was American. But you really begin to see that trend pick back up with maybe Eisenhower, and with the exception of Jackie Kennedy, it has gotten stronger and stronger over the years.
Well, let's talk about Mamie Eisenhower, the other Iowan first lady. And Mamie was, again, a beautiful woman, and she loved the color pink.
Mamie Pink. And the American public, the American women adopted it. And quite honestly, I happen to like Mamie Pink, too.
A very delicate, very feminine pink.
Absolutely. Mamie Eisenhower comes in as the first Republican since Herbert Hoover. No, excuse me. Eisenhower comes in as the first Republican since Herbert Hoover after we have had the Roosevelt and the Truman administrations. Neither Eleanor Roosevelt nor Bess Truman can necessarily be considered fashion icons. And Mamie comes in and she's in her early 50s. She has that interesting hairstyle with the bangs, which was what was recommended by her hairdresser to cover an extremely high forehead. And she comes in with very feminine styles, the gorgeous Mamie Pink, beautiful jewelry, very well put together. And American women loved her and wanted to imitate everything she wore, including the bangs.
Well, let's talk about she made some very political choices as well about what she wore. And I want to hear about the bag that she carried during the first inauguration.
Okay. The dress that she wore in the first inauguration in pink was made by the house of Nettie Rosenstein. Nettie Rosenstein was an immigrant to this country back in the 1890s who loved to sew and who was able to develop a fashion house. She had originally done just simply designer dresses and in 1931 thought about going out of business. But the department stores loved her clothing and they asked her to design for them. So she reopened and her sister-in-law, Eva, actually started doing a lot of the sewing for more of the walk-in trade and Nettie stayed focused on the couturier. But they were American designers. The woman that Nettie hired in the late 1940s was a woman by the name of Judith Leiber. And anybody who knows anything about purses and high-end haute couture purses may recognize that name because it is considered a very high-end handbag now. Judith Leiber was a Hungarian Jewish survivor of the Holocaust. And she was a refugee in 1946. And one of Eisenhower's army troops by the name of, and all of a sudden I have forgotten his first name.
That's okay.
Gerson Leiber married her. And that is how Judith got to this country. And she was hired by Nettie to design handbags. And she designed the handbag that Mamie Eisenhower carried. And the story that Judith tells about it is that Mamie came in for the fittings for the dress, just happened to walk through and saw Judith in the process of making the handbag. But to Judith, it was a great honor. And it's also a huge testimony to our country about the opportunities that we provide for immigrants. And it was a great way for women to grow in businesses when there were not a lot of women in business at the time.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the first ladies and the politics of fashion. With me is historian and author Annette Dunlap. She'll be speaking at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And you're welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be moving into the more modern First Ladies when we come back after a break. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the fashion of the first ladies and the politics of fashion as well. And we're moving more into modern day first ladies. We've been talking most recently about Mamie Eisenhower, and we'd love for you to join our conversation as well. Is there a first lady whose fashion you particularly admired? Are there first ladies who you feel have made questionable choices about fashion? You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest is Annette Dunlap. She is the author of Frank, the story of Frances Folsom Cleveland, America's youngest first lady. She's also working on a biography of Lou Henry Hoover. And now, Mamie Eisenhower, of course, she's one of Iowa's first ladies, so we do like to talk about her here. But in many ways, she is overshadowed, historically speaking, because, of course, we're coming up on Jacqueline Kennedy, who, when we think about a fashionable first lady, I mean, isn't she usually the one that comes to mind first?
She is the one who comes to mind and in our modern day. And so, historically speaking, Frances Cleveland really was up there in terms of clothing. But nobody remembers Frances Cleveland, and we don't have as many photographs of Frances as we do of Jackie. Absolutely. She is the gold standard, although she may end up getting exceeded by our current first lady, but I don't want to jump ahead.
Right. So Jackie Kennedy, you mentioned before, she was buying quite a few French fashions.
Yes. Jackie Kennedy did buy from Givenchy. She bought from Chanel. She did have as her primary designer Oleg Cassini, who was born overseas but was an American citizen by the time he began to design for her. But he brought with him a lot of that European sense of color and cut and design.
She was definitely a trendsetter. She was not a little woman. She was not particularly, I mean, she was a tall woman.
She was, I double-checked, she was 5'7".
Okay.
But if you look at her standing next to her sister Lee, you can see that she's a little bit bigger boned. I didn't confirm this, but I seem to recall her shoe size was a 10. So she was 5'7" in the 60s for a woman was tall. So she was a tall woman, and she was, you know, not a small build woman. She wasn't big boned, but she wasn't petite.
It's funny because I think of her as being small, those little cinched up suits and then the pillbox hats. Did that start a fashion revolution?
Oh, absolutely. Well, hats were a big deal. And actually, Jackie didn't really want to wear hats. There was a comment that was made to her while Jack was running for president about how she was going to have to tone it down a little bit because she was a little too high end and she had to watch with her hairstyle and she just couldn't get it. She said, "Why do people care about what my hair looks like? My husband's running for president." And she had to be convinced that what she looked like really mattered. And so finally, just whether she was just being flippant or frustrated, she said, "Okay, if they don't like my hairstyle, I know what I'll do. I'll wear hats." But it's really interesting because the hat that she wore, the pillbox hat, still allowed her hairstyle to be shown, whereas if you looked at other hats of the day, it pretty much covered up the hairstyles.
Right. Fascinating. And then I'm sure many, many, many other women wore hats as well. And because Jackie is such an icon and such an amazing story, you also believe she really overshadowed Lady Bird Johnson as well.
Yes. You know, Jackie was a very elegant woman as well as a very physically attractive woman. And so you have a woman who maximized her assets and who also had the money to maximize her assets, who comes in between two sort of plainer looking women. And so Lady Bird Johnson, of course, comes in and you've got the issue with the tragedy of Kennedy's assassination. You have the fact that Lyndon Johnson carries a lot of his own baggage as having been a Senate leader and then, you know, was the vice president. The president shot in his home state and then he becomes president. So Lady Bird's got a lot to kind of overcome. But what we really don't remember is that she, too, had an understanding of good tailoring, of what looked good on her. And so you're kind of back to that sort of Mamie idea of being a more average type woman and learning how to put outfits together that make you look good and that people can tell you feel good about yourself. And there's one shot that I sent you. Folks are welcome to see it on the website. I totally love it. It's a picture of Lady Bird in a pair of jeans, a pair of cowboy boots, and a Western style shirt. And she's sitting on rocks with her one leg cocked up. And you can just tell this is a woman totally, totally comfortable in her own skin and in her outfit. And that's a lot of what Lady Bird communicated in her clothing.
And did she dress that way when they were in the White House?
Well, that picture was probably taken on their ranch. So we attribute Pat Nixon to being the one who first officially wore a pantsuit. But Lady Bird on the ranch was photographed in jeans.
All right. So it was okay to wear pants on vacation or back home.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did that cause any kind of a stir, seeing the First Lady in jeans?
I don't think it did because I think it was understood that they were Western.
Okay.
And now if Jackie Kennedy, as Jackie Kennedy, has shown up in jeans, although, you know, she rode, but she was always photographed in her riding outfits.
Right.
So, yes,
right.
I think back in the 60s, it would have been quite talked about.
Now, Pat Nixon, I mean, again, to jump ahead a little bit and talk about the politics of fashion, I mentioned at the beginning of the show Pat Nixon's cloth coat, which, of course, was worn to show frugality and sense, being sensible and being in touch with the rest of the nation and all of that stuff.
Yeah, being conservative.
Right.
Yes.
And so, you know, first ladies have to make choices based on what that choice communicates, whether Jackie Kennedy wanted to believe it or not, but what that choice communicates to the public. But you mentioned Pat Nixon wearing slacks. Was that a very calculated decision on her part?
It had to have been because she's also quoted as saying that the reason why she doesn't wear slacks in public is because her husband didn't like it. Mm. And one of the things that I think is really interesting when I look through photographs of the Nixon years and I look at the daughters is I do not see one publicly published photograph of either Pat or Julie or Tricia in pants ever. So I thought that was very interesting. Pat's appearance in slacks officially, I was not able to find the photo for it, but she actually did a photo shoot for Ladies' Home Journal in 1972. She is the cover girl. beat out Vogue on that one. And she is quite lovely in that shoot, and she is modeling two pantsuits, all by American designers, by the way. And she talks about how American designers should be celebrated and supported.
Now, you are coming into West Branch to give this talk partially because there is an exhibit at the Hoover
Yes.
Presidential Library and Museum right now that shows some of the fashions of the first ladies.
Right.
And when I visited that exhibit, I was really stunned by Pat Nixon's gown because it is so lovely. And and now, of course, you know, this shows my historical ignorance as well. But when I think about Pat Nixon, I don't think, wow, what an amazing gown. So she was really, I mean, she was wearing some very beautiful things as well.
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about politics and first ladies' choices, one of the sad things is that a lot of times what first ladies accomplished get overshadowed by what happened in their husbands' administrations. So, you know, just to back up real fast, you know, Lou had some tremendous accomplishments, all overshadowed by the fact that the Depression hit and Burt, as he's better known, you know, really couldn't get Congress to go along with him for some of the things that he attempted to put in place to try to deal with the issue. And so a lot of what's happened with Lou's been forgotten. Jackie, I think, has been raised on a pedestal in part because of the tragedy of JFK's assassination, but her ability to keep herself in the public eye for so many years afterwards. And Pat is lost to us because of Nixon's resignation to basically avoid impeachment and probably conviction.
So let's go ahead and move on anyway to Betty Ford, who was a dancer, you know, a model, a beautiful woman who loved to wear beautiful clothes. She really made a commitment, though, to buy American and wear American designers.
She did. And in the Parsons School of Design, which is where they do fashion designing, actually gave her an award in 1975 for supporting American fashion. We don't remember, but at that time, inflation was horrible. We're talking 10, 11, 12% interest rates and going up. And the economy was in a terrible, terrible tailspin at the end of the Vietnam War. Ford was trying to manage all of this. And Betty Ford worked with an American designer, male designer, his name I cannot recall, but he designed affordable gowns that cost no more than $300.
Wow.
It was a huge statement on her part. And 7th Avenue, which is the great fashion section of New York City, they totally loved her for everything she was doing to help them out.
All right. Now, I'm worried that we're going to run out of time, so I want to fast forward a little bit. I mean, we think about Nancy Reagan with her beautiful red gowns, and she got criticized for wearing far too expensive
and wearing red and wearing sleeveless.
Right. But let's move on to, I think, the modern first lady who has been beat up on the most for her fashion choices. And she's even made some jokes about it herself. This is a clip of Hillary Clinton. She is at a tribute to designer Oscar de la Renta. And you can hear what she has to say.
I am going to be pitching Andy and others on a new show for Bravo to sort of fill that gap that is so apparent to some of us. And all you really need is a small but passionate audience to be successful. We could call it Project Pantsuit. We have all kinds of ideas.
So Hillary Clinton making a little bit of fun of herself for her devotion to pantsuits. But boy, she had a really hard time finding her style when she got into the White House. And here's a woman, much like Jackie Kennedy, who I don't think was prepared for people to talk about her hair and to talk about her clothes nearly as much as they did. And really, who would be prepared for that? Because they didn't leave it alone.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Hillary is our first attorney as first lady. And just a little aside here, Pat Nixon was our first lady with a graduate degree. So we are starting to get better educated first ladies. Hillary actually was known as Hillary Rodham until the Clinton campaign started. And this just blew her away. This was not the relationship she had with Bill. She obviously was very integral in the campaign, but then she gets into the White House and she finds out that all of the expectations of first ladies apply to her, and the changes she's going to try to make the wheels are sort of stuck in place, and there's not enough WD-40 to loosen them up.
Although, you know, the pantsuit really works for her. I mean, she found something.
Yes, the pantsuit worked for her. She is a little bit stocky. She's a little bit big-hipped. This was, you know, still when she was slender. That's just her build. But that long-cut pantsuit, where the jacket's coming below the hips, and, of course, the pants that hide the thick-set legs, is very attractive on her, and it's a great fashion statement. Hillary's build would have been great during the days when we still had long skirts, but that's not how we wear clothes anymore.
Well, and I'm watching her as a senator and, you know, as her political career has continued, this pantsuit has continued to evolve, and she wears the longer jackets now with sometimes the brocade, and I think they're very becoming, and her style has evolved, and the pantsuits have evolved as well.
She has found some people who understand what looks good on her, and I think we get back to what do we choose about what does what we choose about what we wear say about us? I think how she dresses now talks about how she is comfortable about who she is.
Now, we have just a couple of minutes left, and you think that perhaps Michelle Obama may eclipse Jackie Kennedy as being the most fashionable, the most iconic white or first lady when it comes to fashion. And here we have another statuesque, beautiful woman. She's not a small woman by any means, who has made some really daring fashion choices.
She has. Now, I'm going to kind of throw one at you. I know we're short on time, but could you really see Jackie Kennedy walking into J. Crew or Target?
No, I can't.
And that is the absolute beauty of Michelle Obama's fashion choices. This is a woman who is buying from stores where you and I can go in. If we like the style and we think it's good on us, hey, I'm wearing the same thing the First Lady is wearing, and that's cool and that appeals to us. But at the same time, she will appear at a state dinner or a diplomatic dinner in an American-designed gown that just totally dazzles. Such as the gown that she wore recently when the French president was here. And so Michelle has understood how to sort of, you know, mix it up, how to do high-low dressing, and how to make it work for her. And I think it's also part of where we're headed as a country. You know, Target, for example, has hired designers to design a line for them with that designer's name on them to kind of bring high fashion down to an affordable price. And Michelle's in that. And I think American women appreciate that.
So this hour, we have talked about so many revolutionary, accomplished, brilliant women who were filling roles that other women in America weren't filling yet, that were really leading a lot of changes, not just in fashion, but in many other ways. So why is it so important to talk about what they wear?
Well, for one thing, it's kind of who we are. We just like to see what other people are wearing. We check it out. The other thing is that when you look at what communication is, the experts will tell you communication is just a little bit over 70% visual. So we are getting all of our sensory is coming through the eyes. All of that processing is coming through our vision. And we are making snap judgments about people based on what they wear. Do we like them? Does it fit? Does it look good? Would it look good on me? Do I like the hairstyle? Do I like the hair color? Is it fair? Not necessarily. But it's who we are and it's what we do. And that's a lot of the reason why it makes it important.
Well, and it seems it's so, in a way, unfair to women. Men wear suits.
Yes, they do. And I can remember when this was back in 2008 when Hillary was running for the Democratic nomination, and I had an opportunity to hear one of the reporters who was following her, and they said, she takes 2 hours to get dressed, and all Barack Obama has to do is put a suit on.
Absolutely. Well, Annette, thank you so much for being
thank
here
today. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Historian and author Annette Dunlap. She's the author of Frank, The Story of Frances Folsom Cleveland, America's Youngest First Lady. She'll be speaking at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. Her talk is entitled First Ladies and the Politics of Fashion. And, of course, if you go to the Hoover Museum, you'll also get to see some of those fashions up close and personal. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day. This is Talk of Iowa.